Good morning, afternoon, or evening. Please delete as appropriate. Hello there, and welcome to this episode number 455 of the Material Podcast. I'm Andy Anatko. Florence Ion is off this week. So we're going to at least start with kind of a weird start to this. I had a lot of fun. Over the past couple hours, I've started to record a little bit later than I originally intended. Let me tell you a little bit about what happens when we call an audible and I wind up doing a solo podcast. I have a tendency to ramble because, hey, I live alone. I also got a brain from the dent and scratch collection at the supermarket. And as a result, if I'm having too much fun talking about a topic, I kind of lose myself. So just to make things more efficient, I'll start off recording a solo podcast by kind of writing out a full script. I don't necessarily follow this full script or read this full script, but at least I have done sort of a live off the cuff stream of consciousness version of this. And I can actually read it and say, okay, that's a bit long. Okay, let's trim that. Oh boy, I'm glad I didn't actually say that in front of an audience. People will set me on fire. It's very easy to set things on fire, especially with today's modern technology. I don't want that to happen. So it got finished. And so, okay, good. So now I can actually sit down and record it. But then I thought, I wonder what ChatGPT and Gemini Advanced and Claude can do with this. One thing that always comes up when I write these scripts out is that my writing voice is a lot different than my speaking voice. And the difference is that, like, I write without any regard about how difficult any of this will be to actually speak into a microphone. So sometimes I have a love for long sentences. Sometimes I love the semicolon. I think it's an unheralded piece of punctuation. But then I get to the point where, oh God, Andy, oh, this is just one big, this is like having to put 18 salted crackers in your mouth and then try to swallow them all at once. Please don't do that to me. Oy. So I thought that's good. Well, I got all these tools. And of course, over the past several months, I'm sort of have to make it a pastime to figure out what all of these chatbots can do. And not only so that I can talk about it, but also they're modern tools. I want to be able to use them and improve my work and make my life simpler, better, whatever, if I can. And I'm still in the process of learning what they can do. I'm still very much on the fence about getting it to actually write things for me. But this sort of thing intrigues me, that here is a 5,000 word full script, not necessary. It's a full draft, a first draft. I haven't done anything to optimize it whatsoever. I haven't even like reread it yet. Can I use these chatbots to say, please make sure that I can read this and in less than an hour? Please make it easy to speak aloud. So chop up any super long sentences or anything else you can recommend, and give me sort of an overview of things that might be problematic. Any sort of that. So even though there is a very, very long and interesting topic for an intro, I'm jettisoning all of that so that I can talk about this experience. So in the past hour, I've run not only the script through these three chatbots, but also taking note of like what the experience is like. And the more I use multiple chatbots, the more I appreciate what the strengths of each one of them is. I don't think I'd have as high an opinion of Gemini as I do if I were using it in a vacuum. It has an approach that I really, really like. It is very, it tries to be an assistant. It tries to be the invisible hand. Like, it's not going to do your work for you. It's going to help you to make your work better, ideally in ways that you are guiding it to help you. Areas in which you have identified that, hey, I want you to do this, or I'm concerned about that. Now, I'll start off by saying that there is one trick to prompt engineering that I've hit upon and it always seems to work. I feel as though if I take my Mr. Rogers voice when I'm asking these chatbots to do stuff, I always get better results, and I don't know why that is. So I will always start off by introducing myself and saying, "Hello, Claude. I've never used you before, but I have heard so many good things about you and how good you are at what you do. I am really looking forward to this. I can tell that you are going to be a big help in me developing this this podcast episode script and making it even better. And I don't know, it seems to, I've tried doing tasks with and without this preamble. And oftentimes, like, if things go haywire, it happens when I'm not Mr. Rogers. And even when if the whatever it is gives me a result that wasn't quite what I wanted, I will always start off by saying, wow, that is a very clear, detailed response. Now, I'd like to try this again, and here's what I would like you to focus on. And it's weird that the people who are kind, the people who had kind people, encouraging people around them growing up, they're at a much, much bigger advantage right now than people who learned how to be mean and cruel and have no empathy. Because I think those are the person that are every time you go onto a blog or a news site and you've got this horrendous example of this chatbot going haywire and saying, I am your new golden god, bow down before me or be smitten in the baptism of purification that is to come. Maybe it's because you are kind of being a psychopath when you're talking to this thing. If you are clear about what you expect to do, here's what the goals of this interaction are going to be. Here's what I want you to do. I'm going to reinforce the things you did correctly. When you did something that I didn't expect or I didn't want, I'm not going to browbeat you. I'm going to look on that as an opportunity for me to be clear about what my intentions are. So, yeah, wouldn't it be great if part of the side effects of using these chatbots is that in trying to selfishly get what we want out of these artificial software tools, we are accidentally training ourselves how to be nicer to each other? Well, that remains to be seen. So, okay, so here are what my two goals were. I wanted to make a experiment with a slightly shorter version of this 5,000-word script. I wanted to, again, avoid any stumbling blocks that would make it hard for me to write it, to read it aloud, you know, stumbling over things that are easy to type, hard to pronounce. And also try to look for things that I'm not even aware of that could possibly, you know, tank this recording or tank the comprehension of this. The three of them did things in three different ways. Now, I'll start off with Gemini because, of course, that's the one that I started off first with. I'm going to be talking about Gemini a little bit later on as part of the show. And here's what I really, really love about Gemini. It really is, like I said, it tries to be an assistant. So when I explain to it what I want it to do, it's enthusiastic, it's very, very positive, and starts off before I've given it a script or anything. Well, here are some basic things that we can focus on. Like, here's what makes for clear communication. And here are different approaches we can take in working together to work on the script. You can paste in certain excerpts and ask me for tips on specific things about that excerpt. You can give me access to the Google Doc, and I can actually add in little notes, giving you ideas and things to think about as you rewrite this yourself. I could be more hands-on interactive if you'd like. And I'm like, oh boy, this is great. And this is exactly what I'm hoping for in Google's AI interludes, that it's got so many great services and infrastructure. The idea of tying all this together with Gemini sounds like amazing stuff. Wonderful. And of course I did write this whole thing in Google Docs. So bingo. And it's so typical of the things that I don't like, that make me concerned about Google's future, because it gets through this explanation about here's how we can collaborate. Give me a link to the Google Doc. Make sure that the link is enabled for editing so that I can add notes and my own inputs and things like that. And let's get started. So say, oh, great. Here you go. Here's the link. And it will say, oh, I can't edit Google Docs. And here's the reasons why. There's a possibility of security. And also there could be like, yeah, but you just got finished telling me about this wonderful little yellow brick road that we're going to be dancing down towards together in harmony and unity towards our shared goals. It's weird that these things are still happening. I'm glad that it tries to be safe and secure, but yeah, I wasn't able to say, yeah, I'm not concerned about that, but I am concerned that you told me earlier you could do this, but now you're saying you can't. So it doesn't come across as a defect, but it does come across as usual, as though one department at Google, the Gemini department, is getting a memo. However, the Google Docs department is not getting the memo. So that makes things kind of weird. Now, ChatGPT, you know, see, I'm very, very impressed with the technicalities of how good it is. Like the it's sort of like judging a worker judging an athlete by, here's how fast this athlete can run. Here's how much weight this athlete can lift. Here's how long this person can participate in an endurance activity before giving up or before like degrading. And you're really impressed with all this sort of stuff, all the stuff that ChatGPT can do to manipulate and identify text. But its approach is just very, very weird. Whereas Gemini was very, very helpful, like, and not just in this task, but I also collaborated with it on new ways of cooking chicken tonight, because I had these chicken thighs and I had these ideas for, oh, you know what? Can I use chopped up pickles as a breading sort of thing? And so we kind of collaborate on how to do that. And yeah, we're working together. And every time like I make a suggestion or make a change or try to send us in a new direction, it follows with me. Whereas ChatGPT, if it's started off doing, asked it, can you just do this, give this a rewrite? And ChatGPT, yes, sure, absolutely. And it rewrote it, even when I carefully, as I did with, had done with Gemini, started off by explaining, here is the purpose of the Material podcast. Here's the tone. Here is who I am and what my voice is like. Like, you know, the tone is, I'm trying to cover the news, make sure that there's factual details, but every week the focus is our reaction and our insight into the news and how we put this in a context of our points of view and stuff like that. And Gemini absolutely took this into consideration. However, ChatGPT rewrote the script in the most, like, it had nothing to do with my voice. It sounded like ChatGPT. That's what it sounded like. It sounded like it had been AI generated. It sounded like a piece of software that thinks it's going to be found out at any time. And when it gets found out, it's going to be punished badly. And so it's really trying hard to be bright and sunny and cheerful. And I really didn't see any of my tone of voice and my voice in that at all. Didn't preserve that at all. And when I, again, went to Mr. Rogers mode and said, okay, I'm very impressed with how quickly you did that. Oh, by the way, ChatGPT, boy, is it fast. It responds so quickly that you wonder if it really understood the assignment. I love Gemini's interface, and because it really helps you to follow what the workflow is. One of the reasons why that interface is so meaty is because it can take like a 2 or 3 second pause before it will actually respond to stuff. And so it needs to have like little animations to kind of make sure that you understand that it's thinking and that it's processing. ChatGPT, I don't think it actually needs that. However, well, it's easy if you just like keep giving me back pretty much exactly what you gave me before and ignoring my saying, yeah, I just think it's very, very cold and dry. It sounds like something that anybody could say. It doesn't sound like it's anything specifically me. For instance, in the intro section, I wish that you had done this or there was an opportunity to preserve that. So I'll do that again, just like you said. And then all the things I didn't like about it were right there in there immediately. Oy. Now there's a third chatbot that I tried for the first time. It's called Claude. It's been around for a while. It's one of those things that sort of was on my radar. I just never really gotten around to giving it a really big try. People who have been talking about this new update that came out just this week have been saying, my goodness, this is a leap forward. Now I should also, this is an opportunity to point out that every time someone points out that, oh my God, there's a new version of Claude and now everyone else is in catch-up mode because this is clearly a breakthrough. Well, yeah, that's what I hear every single time there's a major update or a new contender comes out. It's just different and people are excited about something that's different. They've all got their same kind of foibles. And sometimes what I appreciate about a new update or a new chatbot I haven't used before is just this new approach. Claude is truly distinct from both Gemini and ChatGPT. If ChatGPT is like getting something out of a vending machine And Gemini feels like a real back and forth collaboration. Claude is kind of like that assistant that you trust, or the Claude that is the assistant that knows that you trust it a lot, that I don't think that it needs a lot of fine-grained guidance, is very, very good at doing very large things based on not a whole lot of hand-holding. So it's a different sort of thing. And also, I thought that it had... obviously, you can hear me thinking about what I'm saying because I'm talking off the cuff. And also, this is really the first time I've spent even an hour with Claude. It doesn't feel like a really in-depth environment to really explore what you're trying to do. Again, coming back to Gemini and how much I personally appreciate the collaborative environment. I mean, that recipe that I developed, it wasn't necessarily suggesting me that I go down different streets and experiments and alleys. It's just the conversation, a bunch of ideas kept presenting themselves, and I wound up with a recipe that was much different from what I thought I wanted to begin with. Like, again, like chopping up pickles. Like, well, what if instead of just like roasting, baking it as is, what if I put it on a bed of like crushed tomatoes? And now we're talking about things that I could add to crushed tomatoes that would balance with the breadcrumbs, balance with what I was adding to the breadcrumb mix. I felt as though I was, the creative juices were flowing. Claude, I think it feels as though, in a very, very preliminary opinion, it feels as though it's good at doing things in just one, two, or three shots. I'm wondering how hard it would be to use this and feel as though I'm developing ideas of my own, as opposed to appreciating that Claude has come up with a decent, at least, idea for me. Now, I will say that, also another thing I like about Claude is that we're talking about this, just the simple fact that I have a document. It is 5,000 words long. It is a Google Doc. How do I give it to you so that you can look at it and give me answers based on what I've given you? And how can you make changes and give those changes back to me? And Gemini was clearly the king here in terms of what it thought it could do for me, as I've explained. In practice, I still had to pretty much just cut and paste text into the prompt box, and then like cut and paste things out of the chatbot window and back into a brand new Google Doc. This is, again, let me go back to that, because that is such a consistent source of weirdness that I will ask it explicitly, how do I get your generated text out and back into a Google Doc? And we'll say, well, you can do a cut and paste, you can do this, that, and the other. And I'm sort of nodding, and I'm saying, wow, those are all very, very helpful. Now, can I ask you why you didn't suggest that I just use the little button underneath the results and select export as a Google Doc? And then went on to explain to me once again that, oh, well, it's privacy and security. If you were to give me access to Google Docs, it would be a problem. Like, yeah, but did you talk to the guy who actually put this interface, this export to Google Docs interface into that? It's like, I want to help you. It's like, goodness. It's like walking on a sidewalk and you see a bit of trash like on the sidewalk, and you would like that. There's a sanitation company that fixes the sidewalk for you, but you know what? I'm going to pick up this bottle for you and put it in the trash. It's like, I want to be the person who tells you, Gemini, that here's this thing that you should probably correct right now. Claude, however, cuts to the quick with it. There is just a simple upload button in the prompt box. Gemini has one too, but it's just for pictures. So why can't I just simply do documents like that? So Claude made it easiest of all. Now, I don't think any of the three was able to do what I wanted it to do. Maybe it's because I really didn't set this up as a project. I did this as a whim. As I record this, I kind of want to have this recorded over the next hour. I'm handing it over to Jim like first thing in the morning. So that would be like maybe 9 o'clock. So I got plenty of time to record it, but I certainly didn't have a whole lot of time to like experiment with all these chatbots and spend 3 hours navigating the possibilities of each one of them to automate a process that probably would have taken me only about 20 to 30 minutes for me to do on my own. I'm sorry that I keep coming up with other things that I keep remembering at the last minute, but Gemini was so fine-grained with his advice that it said, well, first let's talk about your problem where you want to make sure that you can read it all. You don't want the episode to be longer than an hour. Here's ways to do that, and here's why don't you take a reading test, reading stuff aloud, and tell me what your reading rate is. And then I did it, and I told, okay, great. Here's a table that sort of breaks down how many words you would need to be to make this goal. Here's how many words would make to be to take that goal. Wow, that's great. But again, none of them really fulfilled the brief. Of the three, I still, despite all the frustrations, I would be sticking with Gemini. I think Claude would come in second because it was at least giving me interesting, fast results and nice iterations. I don't think ChatGPT really helped me at all. That is another thing that keeps coming up. It's like I don't think I would be getting the full palette of what chatbot can do for me if I only had one of them. For instance, I do find that ChatGPT is way better at coding, for me at least, than Gemini is. Gemini, again, I don't want to collaborate on. I just give me some code that I will just have to tweak or do a little bit of debugging on. I don't want to go on this great journey of how to hook up a button like in a Google spreadsheet. I just want to know what is the code and where do I paste it, and that's it. So I think I'm gonna have to keep working with Claude to find out what its job would be. Now, before we start with the actual show, though, I'm going to do an experiment, and I'm taking a little bit of a risk here, but this is too much fun for me not to do it. So the last thing I did, realizing that, oh God, I should probably start recording soon, is I thought, okay, just for fun, knowing that one of the core things that a language model should be able to do is just simply summarize things. It's one of the most valuable things for it to do. There are so many times where I will give a chatbot a PDF and just say, please just summarize this. A 600-page PDF in 2,000 words, 1,000 words, so I at least get a head count for what's going on in here. So I thought, okay, here's a 5,000-word script. I got each one of them to summarize it in 250 words. So, and I'm gonna read all three of them in toto, so that in itself will show you kind of what each of these three are about. It will also kind of, I wonder if you'll be curious to scroll back, to rewind back to the start of the show after you've listened to the entire show and try to match up how well the summaries actually worked. Of course, you're going to get spoilers for the whole episode. I'm okay with that. You're also going to get a summary of what the original intro was. I wrote a whole long bit about some adventures I've been having with Google Photos and how it kind of put me into a mind of what it is to watch a movie of your entire life. So you're listening to this instead of that. So you'll hear a summary of that in each one of these things. So I'm going to start off with Claude, which kind of was a lyrical summary. Andy Anatko kicks off this episode by reflecting on his recent late-night binge of organizing his Google Photos library. While originally intending just to remove duplicate images from his 4,500-strong artwork album, he found himself going down a rabbit hole, meticulously creating new albums based on various patterns and moods he noticed in the photos. This led to insights about artistic trends, his own photographic habits, and even an affirmation of his valued friendships captured over the years. The intro segues into tech news, starting with a rumor that Samsung may switch to square watch faces on future Galaxy Gear models, departing from their signature round displays. Andy weighs the pros and cons of this potential design change. Next, he discusses updates to Samsung and Google's mid-range phone lineups, including a possible $50 price hike for the upcoming Pixel 8a. He also expresses frustration over Google's casual revelation that the standard Pixel 8 won't support the advanced Gemini Nano AI capabilities due to hardware limitations. The episode's main segment analyzes Huawei's ambitious plans for Harmony OS Next, a new mobile operating system completely decoupled from Android. Andy explores the technical challenges as well as the potential geopolitical implications of a Chinese state-backed mobile ecosystem independent from Google and Apple's global duopoly. Throughout, Andy blends factual reporting with personal anecdotes and speculation, making for an engaging discussion of the latest developments shaping the tech landscape. Oh, Claude, you're so sweet. God bless you. Thank you so much. And I haven't signed up for the paid tier of this yet. So it's not just like, you know, sucking up so that we'll get my money back. Okay, here's ChatGPT. In episode 455 of the Material Podcast, host Andy Anatko takes listeners on a journey through his experience with organizing his Google Photos library. Despite the convenience of AI features, he embarks on the daunting task of weeding out duplicates, finding solace in the manual curation process. As he scrolls through thousands of images, he rediscovers hidden gems and reminisces over captured memories, highlighting the emotional depth photos provide. Transitioning to tech news, he discusses Samsung's rumored shift to square displays for their Gear smartwatches, updates to Google's mid-range Galaxy A series phones, and the potential price increase for Google's mid-range Pixel lineup. However, disappointment looms for Pixel 8 users as Google announces that the device won't support Gemini Nano, its latest AI model. Shifting focus to Huawei, Anatko explores the Chinese tech giant's resurgence despite trade restrictions, particularly with their Harmony OS gaining traction. He speculates on the implications of Harmony OS Next and its potential impact on the global tech landscape. Wrapping up the episode, Anatko extends gratitude to listeners and members of the podcast, teasing Florence Ion's return in the next episode. Okay, very clinical. I don't know if you'd summarize, hey, he's teasing Florence Ion's return in the next episode. Didn't mention it at the very, very top. Also, yeah, it's kind of weird. And it's reminding me of what I didn't like about its help in editing that thing. All it had to hear was that, oh, this is a podcast episode, so I'm going to fill this with every podcast cliche there is. And yeah, that's why I'm like, oh, honey, you're trying so hard. And I love that you're trying hard. And we're going to work this together, but I'm going to help you be better at this. Finally, here's Gemini Advanced. I'm going to read this entire thing and you'll understand all of what I've been talking about. I happened to include like its response to the prompt. Absolutely. Since I can't directly access your script, I'll do my best to infer themes and give a general sense of the content based on what you've shared and typical podcast structures. Here's a possible 250-word summary. The podcast explores the relationship between technology and personal experience. The host begins with a humorous anecdote about staying up late, enthralled by their Google Photos library. This triggers a broader discussion about how our digital lives offer insights into our habits and thought patterns. The focus then shifts to news from Samsung and Google. The Samsung rumor hints at a potential change in smartwatch design, abandoning their signature round display. This sparks reflection on the role of visual design in technology and how it relates to user preference. The Google news focuses on both increased Pixel A series prices and complications bringing a cutting-edge AI model to the Pixel 8. This raises questions about affordability and the balance between hardware limitations and software innovation. The podcast then transitions to Huawei's rise in the Chinese market as a challenge to tech giants like Apple and Google. Huawei's forced development of a new OS, Harmony Next, highlights potential issues around government control, market dominance, and offering genuine alternatives within the tech sphere. The host concludes with a call to support independent voices in the tech space and expresses gratitude to the listeners. And now there's stuff after this. Caveats. Bullet item. This is highly speculative as it's based on limited information. Bullet point. It assumes a news commentary style, which may not match your actual format. How this can be helpful, insightful. Bullet point. It can highlight potential themes emerging for your script that you might not have been actually consciously aware of. Bullet point. It may point out unintentional gaps or imbalances in your content. Let me know if you'd like me to try this with a specific section of your script for a potentially more accurate summary. Yeah, see, I think now you get it. This is why I like Gemini. It's there to keep me thinking and to make sure that I'm always in control, which so will always reflect my voice and stuff like that. I think of the three, Claudia I was the best summary. Well written, really seemed to get the tone of everything. Again, I'm the person who wrote those 5,000 words. I know what's in it. I know what the intention was. Really seemed to capture it. And it was very, very friendly too. So maybe that's something I'm going to have to keep taking a look at with as I keep playing with Claude AI. But not right now. Actually, see, that's the ironic thing. I started off by saying, gee, 5,000 words. I don't know if that's going to fit into an hour-long podcast. I know I'll try different chatbots to see if they can edit it down to make sure it'll fit into an entire hour. And here I am. I've spent the entire first half of that self-allotted hour talking about this chatbot editing process. So now you know exactly where I'm going with this. So hopefully, we'll be able to get through this quickly and efficiently. We're going to get started on this right after this break. Actually, this is going to be super fun. I've spent the interval trying to decide. I now have three different versions of my notes for this show. Okay, so I've got the original Google Doc, which is what I write for myself and for Flo to both be accessing during the show. So it has all the bullet points, all the highlights, all the details that we're not going to be able to remember. So it's right there. With enough lack of detail that we can just let the conversation flow. I have the full script, first draft, very, very, full of blah and misgivings sort of script, like I talked about earlier. I also have the document that I created to help me prepare the original show doc. I don't know if I mentioned it. I'm using an app called Superlist that I've become a bigger and bigger fan of, because it's so easy to for tasks just like this. So I don't know. I might wind up juggling between all three of these windows, because now clearly I have to do all this entire show, I think, in a half hour. At least I think it'll be more fun to do this in just a half hour. So we're gonna have a little bit of a ride between us. Okay, so let's talk about that rumor about Samsung Gear smartwatches. That rumor comes from a Samsung news blog called Sam Mobile, and they seem to think that Samsung is seriously thinking about switching from round watch faces on the Samsung Gear to square ones. Now, let's take this with a grain of salt, because they have no evidence of this. It's just the two words we hear. I've got the actual quote here. We hear that the idea is enthusiastically being considered internally, and it's very much on the cards that the switch is going to happen. So, yeah, it's normally I wouldn't elevate a rumor that's this thin into, hey, let's talk about this on the show, unless it's a topic that's kind of interesting. And I think Flo and I both kind of enjoyed this topic. Now, it was very, very interesting for me, because as it happened, I wrote a little thing about the difference between round watch faces and square ones. I've been wearing the Apple Watch that I found on the beach back in October almost daily. Love everything about it. I think the design of the Apple Watch is great. It's the styling, the thought that goes into it, a certain level of elegance and performance work very, very well. The only thing that's missing from this equation is that square watch face. I'm still convinced that that round is much, much better even for a smartwatch, because square is perfect for digital watch faces. It's great for watch faces on a smartwatch where if I'm trying to get as much information as possible on there, not just the time, but I also want the weather, the phase of the moon. I want my next contact appointment. I want buttons so I can get right to a health feature or a music playback feature. Great for that. I mean, that's as user interfaces since day one have been set up for square screens and square windows and stuff like that. It's a natural. However, since way before digital interfaces, we have been associating a circle with two lines in it that rotate around a central pivot as the natural interface for telling the time. And watch faces that try to incorporate an actual round dial by putting it inside a square screen, it just looks awkward. It might be just me. I'm not going to denigrate the entire design choice, but yeah, it just literally a round peg in a square hole. Now, of course, the Apple Watch faces, they try to mitigate this a little bit by taking the four absolutely empty corners of that square screen that are left behind. Say, oh, well, you can put complications in there. We even have like complications that would be like a progress on a line. It actually puts on a little curve so it fits into it better. And it's nice. It's nice that you're using part of that screen, but it just, it feels as though, oh gosh, here's some blank space. Let's just fill it with some crap. So as a result, the watch faces that I use on the Apple Watch are all either, again, these very, very data heavy designs that are just, let's get as much data as possible in a square format. Or they are like the Snoopy watch face where it's an analog dial, which I kind of prefer, but they don't even try to attempt to do anything with the screen that's left over, except for use it as a canvas for something pretty. In this case, really wonderful, like 2 or 3 second long animations of the Snoopy characters. And there are a bunch of watch faces for the Apple Watch that are like that, where it's almost like an interactive interactive piece of art that's a commentary on motion through time. It's a pretty thing to look at while you're trying to figure out, do I have enough time to visit the bathroom before I have to catch my train? You can use a little bit of beauty in it at moments like that, can't you? So yeah, I wouldn't like it if Samsung kind of gave that all away. It's such a signature of Android Wear. At the very, very beginning in 2014, I think it was, when Google announced Wear OS, Android Wear, I think, they had, okay, we've got to, of course, the default screen's shape is going to be, for all the people who are going to be making, manufacturing watches, is square. However, we collaborated with Motorola to make a round watch face for a Motorola 360, so round screens are also supported. But it didn't take long before everybody decided, designers, makers, users, all decided that, ooh, we like these watches that are round instead. I love that it keeps this device 1 foot in traditional watch design, 1 foot into the future. And I think that that's one of the things that kind of separates, as a style iconic sort of choice, these two platforms, Apple Watch and Android Wear. The other thing is that Apple's made a huge mistake, I think. There are over 100 million Apple Watches have been shipped, I think. Could be more than that. I've got a note here, but I'm not going to waste time scrolling to find it. I did look that up. Unfortunately, the fact that you've got like 100 million watches that are absolutely identical to each other, there's differences in sizes. The color of the metal can be a little bit different, but everybody's got this identical watch. It feels as though like everybody's watch at that level, everyone's wearing like a hospital bracelet because they just got out like after having kidney stones taken care of or whatever. A watch is a personal choice. It's a reflection of your personal style. It's not as though you should be actively caring what people think of you or how people might judge you based on your jewelry or your clothing, but we part of what makes our travel through time and through space on this planet and through social spaces so much fun is these opportunities to express ourselves. And with an Apple Watch, that's an opportunity that's been lost, despite the fact that you can attach your own bands to it. It just feels like I'm not here to talk. I'm another person who has an Apple Watch. Sorry. So I like the fact that Android Wear has a bunch of that diversity about it, even if that diversity starts off with a round watch face. I still tend to regard it as that person's wearing a watch, could be a watch of any design. I see an Apple Watch on someone's wrist and say, okay, another Apple Watch. So I don't want people to get rid of that. I'd be a little bit, I'm cut now again, we've said that this is not a very, very like protein filled rumor by any chance. Maybe they're thinking about it. Maybe they're not. Maybe there's actually some traction on doing this as an actual thing. Maybe it's just something they've discussed and have sort of rejected. I can't think of them suddenly doing an about face like this, unless there were a very practical reason and a big payoff. Like it would make this watch easier to manufacture. For instance, let's say that they want to do an ultra rugged smartwatch for active sports, adventure sports, and people who are in like rough environments. And they've priced things out. They realize that, oh God, so many of the engineering problems we're trying to solve by having a round watch face would be over and done with if we just made this thing square. Hey, let's make the new ultra version of the Samsung Gear square. Great, let's do that. Otherwise, I just don't see the point to it. And again, I hope they don't do it just for change's sake. I don't see any reason for them to do it. Now, next up, we're going to continue on the Samsung track because this has to do with their mid-range phone line. They have, of course, the Galaxy S series, which is their flagship phones. They announced the S24s just last month. So this week, they updated their A series phones. This is their $300 and $500 phone. And now the A55 and the A35. They're just incremental improvements to last year's models. Reading through, they're probably not worth even going into. As usual, you are getting a phone that is substantially as useful as the flagship phone. The only things that are missing in terms of features and performance are things that are absolutely obvious things that you would sort of cheap out on if you're trying to make a phone for $500 instead of $1,200. And by the way, even though it costs like 40% as much, it feels like it's still 80% that same kind of phone. I do think that the A series Samsung phones are really, really great. Okay, but they did make a change. As usual, they're two different models. As usual, only one is going to be available in the US. The other one is available. Both of them are available worldwide. The difference is that usually we get the better A series phone in the US. This year, the A55 is not available in the US, or at least they did not mention any plans to bring to the US. Whereas the A35, the $300 model, is going to be available starting in a couple of weeks. I mean, the differences between those two phones, they're not enormous. They have the same identical build quality. The A35 just, again, kind of once again, they've cheapened the specs here and there in a way that reflects, okay, this is cost about $200 less than the higher expensive model, and it seems like a really, really good value trade for it. So I don't know what this means. I do notice that I think there's a lot more competition and a lot more price sensitivity in the mid-range market these days. Motorola used to have it kind of all to themselves. However, there are more companies that are trying to operate in that space now, and or at least trying to chase after profits that maybe they can get in the mid-range space that they can't get as readily in the premium space because it's just so cutthroat up there. Now, as it happens, we have another piece of news that's kind of related here. That's part of the reasons why I put this in the show doc. So now we've got a German tech blog with a more credible rumor/report. This has to do with the Pixel 8a. Incidentally, we found out that, okay, we've got confirmation that, yes, just as Google has done every single year, they are going to be releasing an A-series version of the latest Pixel smartphone sometime in the middle of the spring. We are expecting this to be announced at Google I.O. As it happens, again, nice piece of luck. Today, Google announced the date for the Google I.O. Developers Conference, May 14th. So I'm expecting them to announce the Pixel 8a on May 14th. Now, normally these are, I think, $500 phones now, but this German blog has been talking to German retailers and they've learned that the price in Germany is going to be increased by about 50 euro. And this is a credible thing to be thinking about because now that we're about 2 months away from what we think the release date is going to be, we're now close enough that retailers are going to be let in on a whole bunch of stuff. There's the more crazy the rumor, the less likely you are to believe it until we are super, super close to the release date. Now Google, or Samsung, Apple, whoever, they have to tell people that they ordinarily wouldn't trust. So like the weekend before the release, if Apple has decided to actually make a curved iPhone, I'm not talking about curved edges on the glass. I mean, like you put it on the desk and it wobbles back and forth like a banana. Like if they've been keeping that under wraps or under penalty of death, but now they got to tell idiots who are working at the mall phone store. And so now it's going to get out. So yeah, so this is a good time for us to learn things about pricing. Now, so this would also imply that the price of the 8A in the United States is going to increase by about $50. That would take the base model from $500 in the US to $550. Now that's, first reaction is that, yeah, that's kind of a bummer, a price increase on a phone that's probably more targeted to budget-conscious buyers to begin with. yeah, that's going to be not a problem, but at least a source of friction. But it's fine because for a couple of special reasons. First of all, keeping the prices of the Pixel line low was a lot more important in the early days. Still to this day, I think one of the greatest values I've ever got on a brand new phone was when I bought my Pixel 4a for $350. It was a hell of a lot of phone for not a lot of money. So cheap that I actually bought it not intending to get the usual, like hopefully 3, 4, 5 years if necessary out of it, but because I've got money put aside, I've had $1,000 put aside for either a new flagship iPhone or a new flagship Samsung or a new flagship Pixel for a long time now. But I'm not interested or intrigued by any of them. I bought this $350 phone just to tide me over for a couple of years, waiting for any of these companies to do something exciting. That's how good a value it was. But now things are a lot different. Now, for one thing, Google has stolen a page out of Apple's playbook. They've stolen the Indica, the table of contents, the free bookmark that came into it, the coffee stain, the dead bug that squashed in the middle of the book. They've stolen a lot of things. However, in this case, they have decided that Apple's idea of let's make sure there's a broad spectrum of prices available by simply not only just having cheaper versions of phones, but also by keeping older phones like in the price list for a couple of years after they're current, but just keep making the price lower and lower. So the minimum buy-in for a Pixel phone, if you go to the Google phone, the Google store, is the Pixel 6a from 2022 for $349. Still a very, very solid phone, even though it's a couple of years old. That does bring us to the other reason why I'm not quite as worried about it. Artificial intelligence. That's the reason why I finally got excited enough about a flagship phone to finally buy it, my Pixel 6 Pro. The idea of we are basing this entire phone around features that are going to be empowered by AI. We have an entire AI based processor called the Tensor that we're using around this. That got me super excited, and it's been paying off year after year after year. The most useful features, the most intriguing features of this phone have always been the ones that are powered by that AI chip. And now we're in 2024, especially in reflection of Apple's kind of nervous and insistent talking, we think that great things can be done with artificial intelligence, and we're looking forward to making major announcements about it and how it relates to the iPhone sometime later this year. They never talk about, they won't even acknowledge there's going to be a new iPhone this year, but they've been getting so much shade about how, you spent billions of dollars on a self-driving car that turned out to be a nothing burger and a write-off. You spent billions of dollars on high-tech magic goggles that you thought in 2014 was going to be where the future of the world is in 2024. But now you've learned that, oh no, it's AI, not let's have like fake cartoon elves on our desktops that we can only see with $3,500 magic goggles. But yeah, that's going to be table stakes for features on every single phone. So now I think there are going to be limitations to what a lot of companies can do with a mid-range phone, where if it doesn't have enough processing oomph, doesn't have enough RAM, system memory, all this sort of stuff, so that it can run AI models locally, it's going to be a very much a different thing. It's going to be in a different class of phones, almost like a phone that only has like one camera sensor on it. This is definitely in a separate sort of class. It would almost be unfair to compare it to almost anything that has a traditional modern camera array. You're clearly trying to get to the lower end of the market. That's what's going to be like a phone that can't run even a minor sophisticated AI model strictly on device. So I think we're seeing kind of an end to that. Now, this also leads me nicely to why I miffed with Google this week. And you heard me talk about this in that summary. I bought the Pixel 6 because AI was really promoted as the halo feature of this line of phones. This is an AI phone. Before we even thought about the concept of an AI phone, that these are going to be so good at running AI features that you can't imagine taking pictures without such a thing. You can't imagine screening calls without it. You can't imagine being in a meeting and recording a meeting without having these summaries and these transcripts happening automatically. To say nothing of these magic demos of, hi, I'm actually talking to my grandfather, who doesn't speak English very, very well, and I, who don't speak like our cultural shared language very well, but we can communicate very, very clearly in our respective native languages because this AI-based translation features can work so fast about it. It is part of the character of the Pixel lines of phones, not by accident, by Google's own intent. So when you find out that the Pixel 8, which just came out a few months ago, is not going to be able to run, Gemini Nano, that's got to feel like, not like you've been cheated, but like you have been minused somehow. That it really does make the Pixel 8 into a second-class phone. It really does feel that way, doesn't it? If only the 8 Pro can run this AI model that Google has been trying to insist is, this is what makes Google Google. This is the fruit of all of our inspiration, our creativity, our science, our research, our ethics, our plan for the future. We are so proud. We can't be more excited about showing this to you. It's called Gemini. And oh, by the way, it's not going to run on our latest phone. This is the have and the have not. The Pixel 8 owner is the have not. Now, to give this a little bit of context, this wasn't like a blog post or any kind of a big scandal. The official Google developer channel on YouTube had a live stream that was kind of tied into Mobile World Congress about here's what we're doing for developers in the mobile space. And part of that was a Q&A in which six engineers from Google working in different areas of developer stuff were responding off the cuff to questions that have been submitted during the live cast. And one of these questions asked specifically, when is Gemini Nano coming to the Pixel 8? Because it was released to the Pixel 8 Pro in December as part of the Pixel feature drop, did not arrive on the Pixel 8. And a response came back from, a Google engineer by the name of Terrence Zhang. And he said that Nano will not be coming to Pixel 8 because of some hardware limitations. And he didn't get into any really details at all. Speculation would be that this is based on the lower amount of system memory on the Pixel 8 versus the Pixel 8 Pro. Apart from that one statistic, they are functionally identical. They're running the exact same processor, the exact same interface between the exact same kind of RAM, the exact same kind of interface with the storage. It's the exact same chipset. The only real difference that sort of jumps out at you is 8 gigs of system RAM instead of 12. But that certainly doesn't tell the whole story because Nano definitely runs on the latest Galaxy S24s, and the lowest model on that one has 8 gigs of RAM. The higher models have, I think, 12 and 16, but definitely the intro level model one has only 8. So clearly they're doing that by taking advantage of other performance features of the base level S24 to give it enough oomph. Again, he did not go into details about why Gemini Nano was not coming to the Pixel 8, just hardware limitations. Two words, hardware limitations, and that's it. But he was also saying that, hey, we're looking forward to bringing this to, we're working actively to bring this to a whole bunch of other platforms. The only thing that was kind of stood out, this was another kind of slice of disappointment pie for Pixel 8 users. The team was working to bring Gemini Nano to additional, quote, top high-end devices in the near future. And like in an old cowboy movie, this is what I immediately thought when I heard this quote. Like this line would have been said by this milquetoasty like dentist who's just passing through town on a stagecoach on the way to someplace else. And he would said it like in the saloon without any intention of giving any offense, but as soon as he says it, like the piano player like suddenly stops and there's a deadly silence, and and the silence is broken by like this one man dressed all in black who like calmly puts his cards down on the poker table, then asks the optometrist to, why don't you repeat what you just said about the Pixel 8 not being a top high-end device? And then the camera like shows that out of sight, the guy's like suddenly moving his shooting hand like down to the gun on his hip, like not a top high end device. Oh, I felt that one. So yeah, it's just a sour note. Now there's some good news regarding Pixel 8. You are getting a brand new feature that a lot of people were wondering why it wasn't there when the thing was released back in October. It has both the Pixel 8 and the Pixel 8 Pro have the hardware capability to control an external display plugged in through USB-C. However, that feature had been disabled in these devices. And we can't have nice things. Now, however, this week there was a new version of Android 14 developer beta, and was discovered that there is a new feature. If you plug in an external display into the USB-C port, you now get like a pop-up that says, hey, would you like to mirror this display to this external screen? You don't need like a special new interface or anything really expensive. You just need something that a cable that changes the signals coming out of the USB-C port to something that will go into like the back of that display. So if it's a USB 3 display, just a simple USB cable will do. If it's HDMI, you just need like a cheap cable with the right pinouts. It's just display port over this USB-C connector. I got a few other things to say about that, but I'm going to hold that for our special members only episode, which is of course the special members only episode that Flo and I usually do every single week and is accessible to people who go our health support material and Relay FM by being paid members of Relay.fm. So if you want to get on that fun, head on right over to Relay.fm/material and sign up. You can get access to not only this the new episodes, but all of everyone we've done in the past, everything that all the other creators on Relay.fm have also done in the past. Okay, well, we're going to take another break. I'm going to take a sip of water, and then we're going to talk about the pair of $1 trillion tech companies that are starting to feel pressure from a poor, humble, downbeaten tech company that's only worth a couple of hundred billion. Talk to you again soon. We don't have a hell of a lot of time left in the episode, so I'm going to go over this topic a little bit more quickly than maybe the original script might have indicated. But it's something that it's a story that I've been following for quite a while, and I think is really interesting for Google. So you've heard about Huawei, both as a maker of Android phones that in China, and also as the focus of a lot of legislation, a lot of trade war stuff happening in the U.S. In 2019. They were actually Huawei was actually blacklisted in terms of United States international trade. And this meant that from that point onward, Huawei would not be able to do any business with American companies at all. This was a lot of it was because, let's say, the majority of this impetus by the U.S. government was that they were concerned that if Huawei tries to run the table by becoming the de facto supplier of 5G networks across the world, they were concerned about China's government now having a backdoor into every 5G network inside the United States and elsewhere. As luck would have it, of course, the anti-TikTok legislation was made through the House this week. It now goes in front of the Senate, I think. And of course, that's the one that says that, hey, unless TikTok is sold to a non-Chinese company, it will be illegal to, we're gonna block the use of that app inside the United States because we consider it a security risk. Okay, well, we won't get into that right now, but that's the exact same thing they're trying to do. Unfortunately, it also zorched Huawei out of pretty much everything in the smartphone market, because from that point onward, now they can't get 5G chips. Now they can't develop flagship-grade CPUs. A lot of the materials they need, they would have to source through American companies. A lot of the consulting expertise and engineering they would need for all these features would also have to be done through an American company. And now American companies are forbidden from doing business with them. Now, one of these companies that was doing business with Huawei was actually Google. You might be surprised because very, very famously, they pulled out of China in 2010. They abandoned Google Maps, they abandoned the Google Play Store, all these apps and services because of government censorship, government controls, government interference. They wanted, this was back when it was still Sergey and Larry running the show, and they wouldn't simply, they wouldn't at least take a gander at the balance sheet before making, making a decision of that nature. But Google was not 100% out. They were still helping. Of course, Android was still the most popular mobile operating system. It's the most popular operating system in the entire world. So obviously, this was even well before Apple had an official presence of the iPhone inside the China marketplace. So they were helping Huawei and other companies develop versions of Android for their phones. So no, you couldn't access the Google Play Store, but it still very, very much benefited Google to have a advanced version of Android running on these platforms. It's again, rising tide helps them out very, very much. They don't get the entire basket of chocolate eggs, but they get some of the chocolate eggs, and that's good enough. If I had written that joke instead of simply coming out off the cuff, I would say they don't get to eat the entire chocolate Easter bunny, but they at least get to eat they get to eat the ears off of it, and that's better than nothing. I'm not going to insert an edit point. I want you to see me falter like that. That's part of my sin. So anyway, so these trade sanctions really had a big impact. They were in 2019 when they went into effect, Huawei fell short of its revenue targets by thumping $12 billion. However, they responded to this by saying, okay, well, we're going to have to rebuild. Every single thing that we used to have to farm out, whether it is materials, techniques, engineering, expertise, we're going to have to now figure out how to accomplish all of that in-house, you know, locally farmed. We're going to have to make sure, see how we can, if we can do all this with resources that are limited strictly to China. So they started putting lots more money into R&D. And by at 2023, 2024, they seem to have largely, if not entirely, surmounted all the limitations of this trade ban. They can't do the same like 3-nanometer CPUs as Apple is able to do. However, they have 7-nanometer processes, again, developed entirely in-house that are perfectly adequate. They can do 5G modems now. They've got the Honor, I think it's called the H20, is a very, very big success in China right now. And as a result of the resurgence of Huawei, Apple is having a hell of a time. They are now pretty much neck and neck in terms of the most popular individual brand of smartphone in China, in terms of manufacturer. Of course, Android still runs the table. However, as in terms of manufacturers, Huawei and Apple both have almost identical 17% market share. It's a very, very competitive market. And as a result, Apple has been seeing their fortunes with the iPhone dropping down and down and down. So I've hit so many different financial like analyst sites because everyone has a different take on how in the first 6 weeks of 2024, iPhone sales are down 24%. Apple's feeling such desperation about it that they're offering unprecedented discounts on brand new iPhone 15s through authorized resellers. They are very, very much feeling the pinch. And there's so many weasel words in their quarterly reports now, when they're talking about sales in China, they analysts are asking them pointedly, what are you doing about China? Is this a problem? There are headwinds that you don't seem to have any ability to solve. And Apple has to resort to weasel words to talk about, oh, well, we're still very, very strong, strictly in urban, very specific parts that we're going to limit sales to in terms of this analysis. We're not worried. No, it is a big, big problem. Now, another thing that Huawei did was they figured out how to fix their Android problem how do we get a really good Android operating system on our phones without having any involvement or help or expertise from Google? They had, in 2019, they had immediately like kind of downgrade to the the plain vanilla open source Android version, which is like, it's like not just a rice cake. It's like there's a whole like shelf of rice cakes in the supermarket, and there's one that is like, dude, there is no love, there is no joy in this planet. We are listening to Morrissey as we are manufacturing these rice cakes because there is no seasonings, no flavorings, not even any salt. It literally is just puffed rice held together by sadness. That is what you get when you bite into a big, thick cake of open source Android. However, in the intervening years, they built it up into a very, very credible standard deployment of Android, even though they don't have any involvement. And they're helped out by this, by the fact that, again, they're not competing with anything that Google does. There is a vibrant competitive market for apps and services in China because Apple was out of that business for years and years and years. Google is out of the business for years and years and years. So homegrown solutions were able to take root and flourish before any of these competitors had a chance to mow them down. Okay, but here's where it gets very, very interesting and maybe a little bit worrisome for Google. They're taking things, Huawei's taking things one step further. Not just let's build on top of open source Android, which is what Amazon and a whole bunch of other companies have done. We are going to absolutely eliminate Android completely from the situation. We are, just like we did with our 5G modems and our CPUs, we are going to develop a completely homegrown solution, a completely homegrown mobile operating system. We are not even going to use the Linux kernel, let alone the Android kernel. Okay, that's how deeply we're going to do this. Now, they call this I have to scroll down because I keep mixing it up. Their phone is the Honor. The operating system is Harmony. I keep mixing them up. So their operating system is the Harmony OS. That's what their open Android based version is. The open Android based version will run standard Android apps sideloaded through as an APK. So a lot of people in China are using it to get apps that they may not be able to get through the official app stores. However, Harmony Next will not be able to do that. It has no overlap with Android whatsoever. It is a meticulous, fine-grained, with extreme prejudice break from all things Android. It not only isolates Android, it also isolates these phones from the entire community of hardware and software engineers in China who understand and work inside the extended Android ecosystem. So in doing this, Huawei will have to bear the entire burden of educating all these developers on how to build Harmony Next apps. Okay, what are the APIs? How to get things in the Harmony App Store? Services, all these sort of things. And not only that, but each one of these developers is going to be starting off with none of the necessary skills beyond the knowledge that, hey, if the phone freezes, maybe we should try restarting it and see if that fixes it. That will carry over. Nothing else of their experience will be able to carry over. They're going to have to spend thousands, probably thousands of dollars, and God knows how much time, learning skills that are only going to be applicable inside China. And then only applicable on those phones that are running this version, running this brand new, out of the box, never seen before operating system instead of the single most popular mobile operating system in the world. And I haven't even started talking about convincing consumers to buy these phones that run nothing that they've heard about. And there's going to be a very, very long, long, long runway until there's an app library that is one fraction of a tenth. As lush as what they've got in these third-party apps, Android app stores. So why are they pursuing this? I don't know. I mean, there's definitely an excellent, again, all the other stuff they were doing, they did it because they had to, and they've come out on top. If anything, if part of these trade sanctions was to prevent Huawei from becoming an international presence in the mobile phone commerce space and being able to, again, if you're afraid of the Chinese government surveilling the entire world through anything with a Huawei logo on it, okay, well, now they have learned, they have improved, and now they can do without external influence. Okay, so if anything, it kind of helped them because now they can do everything. They are now impervious to future sanctions because they've learned how to survive. But this, I don't understand it, which leads me to speculate, and I'm going to absolutely underscore that this is speculation. Now, that reminds me, I think it was ChatGPT. It might have been Gemini. when it was asking for, okay, now that you've read it, what do you think about what, how could I improve it? I think it I mentioned that, oh, is it, I, one of the things that makes it so good is that there's like balance between like facts and opinions. At times you should, maybe you could make it clearer when you're saying an opinion. So I want to make very clear what I'm about to talk about is speculation. Again, trying to solve the problem of why are they going so far as to develop an entirely new operating system. Now, this 100% Chinese homegrown kernel OS and app ecosystem, it does fit nicely with the Chinese government's industrial policies. You know, China wants to make everything homegrown themselves. They don't want to have to rely on international companies outside of China, partly because that allows them to control their own destiny as a nation. Also because the government can't control Apple. You know, they can't control Google. However, they can control Huawei because Huawei is a Chinese-based company. And it does make sense that a company as big as Huawei would be working closely with the government no matter what they were trying to achieve. Now, beyond that, it just makes me wonder, so are they setting up, is the Chinese government setting up Harmony Next to become the de facto state mobile operating system of China? Or maybe even the official and only approved one in a best case scenario for them, as far as they're concerned. I mean, I do want to qualify this so much that I disagree with so many contemporary characterizations of the Chinese government. I think many of what we see and hear from people are alarmist, and way too many of them are, frankly, racist. That said, the Chinese government is systematically invested in establishing its authority over pretty much everything that goes on within its borders, whether it's commercially, socially, or culturally. Like the Chinese government, they don't want to run every private company, but they do certainly want to make sure that every company knows that the government can step in at any moment, make a demand, and expect 100% that this demand is going to be fulfilled and promptly so. Because, again, the government does not own these companies. However, they have the ability to essentially pull their license to operate and shut them down. So courtesy is expected. So with that in mind, in the government's eyes, this is an opportunity to directly influence, guide, and ultimately oversee the development of a completely homegrown phone operating system from day one of the project. Like not, okay, well, what opportunities exist within this existing Android operating system so that we could make it more powerful as a surveillance tool? What could we do to modify its existing features and override its protections so that we can systematically target phones to turn on microphones or just shut them down completely? How can we do that? They can do that a lot more easily if they've had a hand in the development of something from the kernel all the way up. I mean, that does seem to be, if they were to get that, they would, it seems as though the China that I know, that's would feel as though that's the thing they've been working towards, that level of control. Again, not we want to own and dictate this operating system. We just want the ability to influence it in any way that we feel is important for us as a government. Now, if that's true in some fashion, then it would follow that the government would do what's necessary to not just encourage this Huawei to be successful with this operating system and creating it. Maybe they would do what's necessary to create market conditions inside China that would practically force its citizens to rely on that one operating system for all of their personal finances and their travel, their messaging and their social contact. Like they can't necessarily ban Android or ban even open source Android. However, they could make things awfully difficult for any phone carrier that wanted to sell Android-based phones inside China. Or they could make it very, very difficult for carriers to carry traffic that way. They could essentially ensconce Harmony OS Next as the de facto state operating system. At this point, when I was writing things, think about what to say. I came up with a description of Harmony OS as Next as potentially a tyrant-friendly alternative to Android. And that's a little bit like incendiary, so I'm just mentioning it as a cultural artifact. But nonetheless, like there are a whole bunch of governments that are very, very interested in the power of these phones in everybody's pockets as a matter of surveillance, a matter of controlling the population, their access to information, locating troublemakers so that they can do things to them so they don't make any trouble for the government in power or the existing power structure. Like India comes to mind. Like this is a country that has so-called hostage laws that tech companies have to operate under. So if Google and Apple want to operate inside India, they can't run it remotely. They have to have offices and employees that are based in India. And if the government feels as though the company anywhere in the world has done something to violate Indian law, all those employees can be arrested and imprisoned or worse. This is why it's thrown up as a hostage law, where if they suddenly decide that, somebody on Facebook said something that was in some way disparaging to a government official, we would like to not only have this person's identity, we want to get access to, we want live access to the GPS of the phone on which that Facebook app is installed. And again, worst case scenario, but it would be possible for them to say, oh, you say you don't want to do this? Okay. Actually, that person we wanted to track, they're a terrorist, and you're aiding and abetting terrorists, and that violates our anti-terrorism law. So here's a 99-year sentence. Although we will re-review your case in 30 days, and maybe the situation will have changed by then. I could, knowing that and knowing how much power they have to control journalists and such, I wonder that if they had the opportunity to have an operating system that was built from the ground up to be very, very useful for governments that like to maintain a lot of control over the population and on their existing power, that could be a very, very profitable thing for Huawei to export. Well, again, that's speculation. These are just things that I find kind of interesting. Back to reality, this is going to be 2024 is going to be the year of this new operating system. They released a developer beta of Harmony Next to a limited list of partners in January. They've stated a roadmap for the release. They want to release a beta to the overall developer community sometime in the second quarter of the year, and then release the operating system to consumers at the end of the year. I assume they mean pre-installed on certain models of Huawei and Honor phones. Wouldn't it be a kick if you could just if it's like, no, please install this very, very brand new and possibly tainted operating system on your precious new Pixel phone. We would love it if you would do that, Americans. I'm sorry. I regret making that joke. For all of my dark speculations about possible worst case outcomes, I'm genuinely keen to see a viable third mobile operating system gain some sort of traction, even if it's only in one country. Like, the world is currently free to choose any mobile operating system they prefer, but so long as it's one of only two choices, and these two choices are roughly identical, and they're both backed by a power structure that is so wealthy, so powerful, and so entrenched that any third-party challenge that rises up outside of that duopoly hasn't a chance in hell of survival. Now that I'm reading that back, that does sound familiar. Here in 2024 in the United States, I can't put my finger on why. Well, chalk it up to the fact that I am a little bit sleep deprived because I've been up all night writing this stuff. So let's just go to the end of the show. Hey, here we are. Once again, on behalf of myself and Flo, we'd like to thank all of you listeners out there and shout out an extra thanks to our members. Thank you for your support. Click on the following audio URL right now by snapping your fingers smartly once at some point while I read it out. Relay.fm/material. Good for you. I heard you. Don't take your hands off the steering wheel, especially with the other wheels and the hands on coffee. I'm not your mother. I'm sorry. I shouldn't get involved. Anyway, Flo will be back here next week. Until then, everybody, please have a healthy, safe, and happy 7 days. Bye-bye.